enlightened panel. I've asked since all our radio producers, among other things, I've asked each of them to play excerpts of their work. It seems to me at a radio conference, we shouldn't just talk about radio, but also listen to some radio. The first speaker, and really the person who conceived this event, is Karen Frillman. She has a long history in public and community radio. She was the producer at WNYC in New York of a program called Senior Edition from 1980 to 1984, after which she worked as an independent radio producer. She won an Armstrong Award for a nonfiction piece she did about a South African maid. She went to school here in New York State at Oneonta, where she was an activist and had been involved with anti-apartheid work. Also produced a series on Cree folktales and health and nutrition. Did a lot of work for NPR and BAI. She was a co-founder of Independent Producers and Sound Consortium, which was concerned about a lot of the issues that I think led to the formation of the grassroots radio movement. Since 1980, she's also a founding member of AIR, Independence in Radio. Since 1989, she's worked on audio books. She's worked with, among others, Alice Walker, Hunter Thompson, Frank McCourt, Randy Schultz, Jimmy Carter. She does all the audio books for the Dalai Lama. And she was a member of the WBAI local board and chair of that board, and played actually a somewhat very, I think, important, somewhat unsung role in the struggle to win back Pacifica. That's for another time, but without further ado, Karen Frillman.
Thank you. I want to play a piece first that I made this year in January, and it's just a portrait of Mo Foner, who was a activist who founded Bread and Roses, and he came up and spent a lot of time in the Catskills, so I thought it was just be nice to remember somebody who has been a cultural worker and somebody who made a tremendous difference. So,
we want to use our talents, our skills, to try to do that.
You can hear in Mo Foner's voice the spirit that he brought to his work. He was for most of his life a union organizer and leader who fought hard to help healthcare workers earn a living wage. But he will be most remembered for bringing culture into the lives of these same minimum wage workers.
People say that I have a passion for this kind of thing, a passionate commitment to bringing the arts to all people.
After he helped found and build Union 1199, the Health and Hospital Workers Union, Mo Foner brought his prodigious talent to another arm of the union. Here, he produced music shows, sponsored art exhibits, and created opportunities for performers to create culture that mirrored the lives of the union workers. He understood that by giving people more than money in their paycheck, by integrating music and theater into the line bedpans for a living, he was giving them something that was priceless. He called this Bread and Roses.
The slogan comes from a strike of textile workers in Lawrence, Massachusetts. It came from 45 different countries, spoke 40 different languages. They found it was a horrible situation. They made $6 a week for working 50 or more hours. And when the mill owners announced a cut in wages, while they were not organized, they just collectively decided to walk out. And they struck in the middle of January, the cold winter, and they carried signs as they marched, and one of the signs said, "We want bread and roses too."
As we come marching, marching, the beauty of the day, a million darkened kitchens, a thousand mill off gray, are touched with all the people here singing bread and roses. red and roses as we come marching.
Mo Foner was born in 1915, the son of immigrants. His father was Seltzer delivery man in Williams, Brooklyn. His mother never learned. As a kid, he played the saxophone. He and his brothers formed a combo to earn money by playing in the Catskills. Jack Foner went on to become leading historians. Mo worked to bring art and politics together.
I came out of the Depression of the 30s. I graduated from college. I was interested then in social issues. It was a period when there were playwrights, poets, writing about working people.
For his fight to unionize workers, Mo found artists who were interested in expressing narratives through song, painting, and theater. Two artists who worked often with Mo Foner were Ruby Dee and Ozzie Davis.
Ruby and I were hired by mine to help sell them. This is 55. Ruby and I were hired performers to go place of major hospitals and to do programs. We would read from Langston Hughes.
Hold fast to dreams, for if dream, life is like a broken that cannot fly. Opens to a dream deferred. What about roses always and never given?
What happens deferred?
Work, labor, creativity. These are elements, but also elements of pride, which make it easy. I have proven that I am a worthwhile. I have created something with my workers are creators, should be at the head of the contributors to our society.
Understood these things. He will be remembered commitment to the arts and to the working. For Studio 360, I'm Karen Frillman.
But a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses.
I was talking to Ralph. I don't know when he had first started talking about this conference, and we had heard about it. And one of the things that I've been doing in the last 2 years is beginning to make documentaries with WNYC, which is the station I work primarily with in New York City. And specifically around land issues, which is a funny thing, but that's where I live, that's where I'm from, that's the only land that I really know. And you know, it's a tough landscape to appreciate and revel in. And so I made a piece about the New York waterfront, which is in a tremendous state of flux right now because it's the next big area that's being developed in New York. And mostly because the water is clean due to the work of people like Pete Seeger and activists and people who have been fighting to clean it up and demand that it be cleaned up. So in the course of, you know, doing that, I realized how weird it is to produce in such a vacuum and to not really know about what's happened in other cities, what are the experiences that other activists and other communities have had in trying to reclaim land or determine the future use of land. I was listening to the radio, and I guess I heard a woman from Philadelphia, and this is a little different issue, but she's talking about the privatization of schools in Philadelphia, and she said, you know, we didn't even know that we could fight it. Whereas in New York, there was a huge effort to actually, and there were, you know, there was a lot of organizing that went on to actually determine the future of would kids in Upper Manhattan, in the Bronx, be going to public schools or the new private schools. And so it seems as if, since people were coming together from different parts of the country who were producing, and, you know, I guess I'm interested in maybe finding ways to just make sure that we share certain kinds of information, as especially I think we're now going to move into a time where water issues and resource issues are just going to be huge, and there's no discussion about it. We avoided major drought problems in New York City, but also in this area this year, only because we had a very, very wet spring. But there was no snow, and the reservoirs were down, and it's very likely that we're going to move into that in the next 12 months in this area. And all over the country, you hear stories about drought. We know Colorado and Nebraska are hurting. We know Texas has been in a has had terrible problems. We know, but somehow I feel like, you know, I don't hear that necessarily. I'm not hearing those reports necessarily regularly on any public stations that I'm listening to. There seems to be no real ongoing report. And I'm hearing more and more talk about the privatization of water, which is, we are going to, I mean, I just feel like I'm just so anxious about this, because I just know that it's not, you know, this is not going to be a fair distribution of these resources. So that's why I hear about that, given that people like Lynn, the whole PSIM movement really pushed everybody to talk in a way that's really different, and maybe some stuff can come. Sort of where, that's the kind of stuff I'm thinking of doing, and the kind of writing and producing I'd like to doing, see myself in the next couple. 11, I mean, should I can, another piece of, from this piece, specifically a piece about parks, which that is public access to water, because there's been very little public access of waterfront in New York City. I, growing up on in the borough of Queens, I never, ever went to the water at all, and I didn't even know that I really lived on Long Island, so... I mean, you know, chalk it up to my education, but, so.
You know, I'm going to suggest that we let the others say
I think
a
so
few
too.
Words, play also some examples of their work, and then, time permitting.
Exactly.
We'll go ahead. next up is Scott Harris, who is the co-producer of a program Between the Lines at WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut. This is a program that was started as a weekly show during the Gulf War, and then broadened to include a whole host of other issues, including environmental issues, national, international issues. Scott is got his start in college radio, as did many people, at Western New England College. Then he worked as public affairs director for WPKN. He's worked as a freelancer for NPR, for Pacifica, and for Free Speech Radio News. Currently, he is director of the halfway house for people getting out of prison, and he's a community organizer. And I think that's significant because many people involved in community radio, while Scott Thule is a radio professional with a long history, his main gig is not in radio, yet he's doing important work in radio. And what I think is important, one of the reasons that we wanted him on this panel, is that he has used the internet to distribute this program, which over 20 stations carry. So it sort of addresses, in part, some of the issues that, that Karen raised. Scott. Yeah, I'll just briefly describe the show, and then we'll hear segments. Is this mic not on? I don't know. At any rate, just talk a little louder. Yeah, as Ralph said, we began the show.
We began the show around Viagra. We began the show around the Persian Gulf War, and it was just a group of local producers in Bridgeport, Connecticut area where we worked, and we put together this show inspired by the Persian Gulf War and the kind of one-dimensional mainstream media coverage. I think history is repeating itself as we speak in terms of a new Persian Gulf War. But we broadened out the issues to include a whole host of things, local, national, international issues. And just moving ahead a few years with the internet, we were able to think more about syndicating the show beyond the Connecticut area, where several stations took it. And my wife and my partner, Anna Manzo, is here. She could tell you a little bit more about internet tech and other issues that you might have some questions about. But we were able to, through listservs and through the recent advent of indie media postings, descriptions of the shows, get a lot of interest out there in terms of broadcast stations and webcast stations, and have the show go out a few different ways. We have the show going out every week. It's a weekly news magazine format, and it goes out. We have a few stations that take it through CDs. We have the Pacifica satellite, the KU satellite, that we have an uplink to once a week. And MP3s really seems to be, the MP3 audio files is the way we get the show out to most stations and websites. And fellow panelist Lynn Geary and her AINFO's Radio for All site was certainly, I think, the first method or tool that we used to make it available through MP3. And we've since then had it on two places on the internet, our own website and the Radio for All AINFO site. We also posted, as I was saying, to Indie Media, as well as to a new service you guys might know about, and that's One World Radio out of Britain. They are now posting audio segments from all over the world, a lot of it from the developing world, from Africa and from other countries. They have it in several languages, so it's pretty widespread and an interesting resource that's fairly new. The other way we get the word out about the show every week is we transcribe one of the interview segments and post that around the internet on listservs, as well as a weekly summary of the show, and you know, in addition to our own sort of email list that we've accumulated over the years. And we have a number of stations, more than 20 stations, carrying it every week, the half-hour news magazine in its entirety, but we have another 10 or a dozen stations that actually take clips, take you know, individual segments and drop them into their newscast. And that became a real resource for a good number of stations during the Pacifica strike, because a lot of the stations dropped the Pacifica news. Not everybody had FSRN. Some stations were trying their hand at producing their own newscast. And so they used our, you know, interview segments as a way to, you know, fill the void. And some stations are still doing that. And it's I think, a pretty good resource, and it's a good way of sharing our audio. One thing that we've been weak in, and I'm hoping, you know, maybe through this conference and just a little more effort on our part, is that we can also attract some, you know, audio segments from outside our small circle in Connecticut where we produce the show, because certainly uploading MP3s and sharing them that way and including it in the show is very easy to do at this point. So maybe what I'll do is just go now to an audio segment. This is one segment produced by our one of our producers, Melinda Tuhus, whose name you might recognize. She does some stuff for Free Speech Radio News, but she's here, and actually she's here at the conference this weekend. And this segment is set up, so I won't go into a great amount of detail, but it's sort of a local story that developed with a coalition of activists and church groups that were investigating Yale University in New Haven in their role in slavery, and it sort of feeds into the whole movement for reparations nationally. But it's a local example of people getting together, investigating an institution, a, you know, sort of internationally known institution like Yale, and putting pressure through the city council, the Board of Aldermen in New Haven, and other ways in the community to sort of connect the local with the national. So maybe we could go to that right now.
Over the past year, the issue of reparations for slavery has resonated in both national and international forums, including the United Nations Conference Against Racism held in Durban, South Africa. In New Haven, Connecticut, a local group took up the issue last spring after the city's Board of Aldermen held a forum on the reparations issue. The group, the New Haven Reparations Coalition, proposed a strategy to research the subject, but that plan was eclipsed by revelations made by three Yale University graduate students detailing Yale's role in perpetuating slavery and racism. Among the facts that the students uncovered was that of Yale's 10 undergraduate residential colleges named for individuals, 9 were named after proponents of slavery, including many whose financial contributions to Yale resulted directly from their owning or trading in slaves. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Reverend Eric Smith, pastor of Community Baptist Church in New Haven, and a spokesperson for the Reparations Coalition, about his group's work and what its members are demanding Yale do to make amends for its past treatment of African Americans.
It was suggested during the public hearing that New Haven create a local task force that would look at the role that New Haven-based institutions played during slavery. So we started convening meetings and had four or five sessions where we actually did formulate a plan and formulate a proposal that the Board of Aldermen are now going to consider.
What are the components of that proposal?
Essentially, we're asking that the city create a task force made up of people who don't live in the city of New Haven, preferably historians, economists, that kind of thing, and have them research the role that the top five employers, including the city administration, played during the days of slavery, seeing if they utilized slave labor in terms of their activities, if they knew that did business with slaves, and just to find out any profited from the slave trade.
What are those five companies?
We haven't identified them. What we're going to do is trust that the historians will do that. I mean, obviously, we knew that Yale University would be at the top of the list. We expect probably the city administration will have a role.
When three graduate students at Yale produced this recent document that showed Yale's connection with slavery and its acknowledgement and honoring of many people who had dealings with slavery in its naming of the residential colleges and an endowed professorships and so on. What was your response to that, or your group's response?
It was essentially, and you got to understand that I'm a minister, it was hallelujah time, frankly speaking, because that literally got released about 5 days after we announced what we were forming. And it was funny that one of the alderpersons who opposes this said that this is going to turn into a witch hunt, and I don't think that they're going to find many witches. Then all of a sudden the report comes out, and we've landed a big witch, so to speak. So we were happy to see that our work was going to bear some fruit. It caused us to rethink our strategy. Our original approach was to just focus on making the case for reparations, and then after the case had been made, start to see what form it could take. Given the fact that this report strongly makes the case in terms of Yale, we've now had to rethink and start creating a structure for reparations. So it was helpful in that respect, and it has now put some structure to our thoughts around reparations.
There was a report recently that pointed out several specific things that I guess your group is suggesting or asking or demanding that Yale do. Can you talk about those a little bit?
Sure. First, to set the context, the Freedmen's Bureau at the end of the Civil War was created to kind of help get freed slaves acculturated into American culture. So their work focused on land, economic opportunity, education, and civil rights. So those four areas, based on that historical precedent, becomes the framework for reparations. As it relates to land, we're asking that Yale rename the residential colleges that are named after people with a pro-slavery mindset after abolitionists from their history. We're also asking them to expand their homebuyer program to include African-American first-time homebuyers who buy homes in the empowerment zone. Under the economic opportunity piece, we're asking them to create an economic development fund so that African-American-owned profit and nonprofit businesses can apply for no-interest loans and for grants. Around education, we're asking them to create a Simeon Jocelyn Scholarship Fund so that New Haven High School graduates can apply for scholarships and get scholarships to go to the college of their choice. Simeon Jocelyn was a pastor of Dixwell Congregational Church. He sought to start an African-American college for African-American slaves and freed. And what happened is that Yale-affiliated officials essentially crushed that effort. They brought it to a complete halt, and as a result, you did not have an African-American institution of higher learning for approximately another 20 to 30 years. And then in the area of civil rights, we're asking them to remove the name of master from the head name of the heads of the residential colleges, and we're asking them to enter into negotiations, so to speak, around creating a social contract with the greater New Haven community. And that'll involve them dealing with their patents with the age drug Xeric. That will involve the percentage of minorities they currently have employed at Yale at higher levels, and that will involve increasing the percentage of minorities who are dealing with other contracts at Yale.
Some people, when they talk about reparations for slavery, think about individual payments to descendants of slaves. What this group is talking about seems fundamentally different, or how context with that proposal?
It goes, given the fact that the slave trade impacted the African American community in total, it doesn't seem realistic to just narrowly sit back and say that the slave trade just impacted descendants of slaves. So on that theory alone, it needs to be broadened to encompass the entire African-American community. So it was never considered that a direct payout be made to individual African-Americans who were descendants of slaves. If we create this larger reshaping of the economic framework, it'll impact the African-American community overall. So that's what we really want to do, impact the community overall, not just set African-Americans.
That was Reverend Eric Smith of the New Haven Reparations Coalition. For more information, call area code 203-562-7060 or visit the group's website at www.yaleslavery.org.
Now, there's not a lot of fancy production there, but I think one of the things that we try and do each week in this way is to connect groups, you know, especially you have that local issue and, you know, maybe somebody hearing it out in California or in Texas or something will connect with this group and, you know, sort of the national local connection, which I think, you know, radio certainly has a critical role in doing, especially in this time of renewed activism. So I'll leave it there. Thanks. Our last speaker is Lynn Gary. Lynn got her start in community radio at KPFK, Pacifica Radio, in Los Angeles. She was fired and banned in 1995 for speaking out as, you know, the takeover was underway. She moved to upstate New York, where she has worked as a producer of a weekly public affairs program on WEOS, Geneva, New York, and she also is co-founder of AINFOS, which is a file-sharing system that very much speaks to the issues that concern us right now. Before turning things over to her, just say two additional things. She's currently involved in starting a community radio station in Ithaca, New York. And also, she played a critical role in terms of kind of internal communication during the Pacifica struggle. So, again, thanks for all of that, and Lynn Gary.
Hi. I wanted to say that, in a sense, nothing really is local anymore. We cannot, as people in any locality, hope to conduct our affairs without the interference of something that happens on a regional, national, international, or multinational level. So I think it's most important that people share those stories and understand the shape of what is happening to us. Now, I now live in a rural area. And for those of you who live in a rural area, you know that the view of the rural area is that this is a place where you dump toxic waste that people from the cities don't want, and where you go to dig up natural resources and take them away to someplace else and sell them for a lot of money, right? Okay. So by that same token, I want to give you a specific example of how file sharing of a local story can work. Ralph mentioned the AINFOS radio project, and I'd like to acknowledge my co-founder, Sean Ewald, here in the audience. The idea was that we, as community radio producers, without a lot of financial resources, ought to be able to pool those resources, because something that happens in Maine, as you will hear, was extremely relevant to us in upstate New York. In this particular case, there's a fabulous program on WERU called Radioactive that's hosted by two women, Meredith and Amy. And one day, and they upload to the radio project, as does Scott AINFOS, as you know, as it's called. And I heard their program, and I said, oh, well, yes, this fits right into my weekly show. This is important, and this is interesting. So I pulled a piece of their interview, and that's what you're going to hear, is basically their interview cut into my show, because my attitude is, I don't have to do an interview myself. What do I care who did the interview? What I care is that this information gets to the people listening. Okay, and so that's like
people have to get over the fact that if they do a show that they have to do every interview. Why, if someone else did a good one? What's the point? Okay, so the main point is to get it to the people listening, and they don't care who did the interview either. So what happened with this was I put it into my program, and someone who was listening, this is going to be a piece about biodiesel fuel and how easy it is to make, and how you can make biodiesel and run your trucks and heat your homes out of waste from, you know, McDonald's and Dunkin' Donuts. From their fryer oil. I played this, and one of my listeners, who was a high school chemistry teacher, decided that he was going to make that a project for his class. And he did, and it was in fact so easy that his class was able to make biodiesel. They tested it, it worked, and so now there is a biodiesel co-op forming in my area as a result of the work of these women in Maine who put their stuff up on the internet. So this, it does work. Okay, so that's what we're going to hear. It makes you feel good. You say, it really matters. We're doing something that matters.
And you cut it with a certain percentage of lye and methyl alcohol. And you stir them all together and let it sit, and you cut it in a virgin made out of vegetables.
One-legged toggling.
So basically what it is, it's a fuel that's made out of vegetable oil. You take vegetable oil that's either virgin, has never been used for anything, or that has been used to in a friolator, like to fry French fries or donuts, and you cut it with a certain percentage of lye and methyl alcohol, and you stir them all together and let it sit, and the glycerin on the vegetable oil molecule actually drops off, and what you have left over are what is called methyl esters, and that's what you burn in your diesel engine. So it's an alternative diesel fuel. You can't burn it in just any gasoline engine, you can only burn it in a diesel engine. And the interesting thing about diesel engines is that although we tend to think of them as being exclusively petroleum motors, they were originally diesel engines were invented to run on peanut oil or oils like that. And the word diesel comes from Rudolf Diesel, who invented the engine. But just at the time that he was inventing this engine, the petroleum industry was getting very strong, and so they were able to exert their influence and make all diesels start running on petroleum because it was abundant and cheap at the time. So once you've made this biodiesel, is what we call it, you can run it in any diesel engine without doing any kind of conversion whatsoever to the motor, which is why it's such an exciting alternative fuel, because these days a lot of alternatives necessitate the conversion of the vehicle. So if you have a fleet of school buses that are diesels and you want them to run cleaner, a lot of times people will want to run them on propane or compressed natural gas, and that means that they have to change all the running equipment in the school bus, and they have to retrain the people who work on the school buses, and they have to put in alternative infrastructure. But with biodiesel, all of that remains the same. You can mix biodiesel in any quantity with regular diesel, and you can switch back and forth, and you can run 100% biodiesel, or you could switch all the way back to regular diesel. And so you don't have to set up any different kind of infrastructure, and the maintenance is exactly the same because you're not changing your engine.
How did you get interested in this? How did you learn about it, first off?
I learned about it about 7 years ago, maybe a little less. I've always been interested in alternative fuels, and I do a lot of work on engines and on cars. Well, for two reasons I'm interested in alternative fuels. One, because of the emissions that come out are so obviously detrimental to, you know, our environment and to our health. But the other thing is just working on these motors is, you know, it's really nasty. You get covered in this, you know, in this diesel, and you get covered in, you know, you're breathing all the exhaust all the time. And it's not nice to see all your mechanic friends get sick once they turn 60. And, you know, I mean, it's a real, real thing that, you know, you can really see the effects of these, of
these poisons that we're relying on to transport us, and there's so many other ways to provide transportation to ourselves that aren't poisonous, and this one is, I found most attractive because it's renewable, it's domestic, and it's so easy. It's so easy to do, and there's other better alternatives which will be coming online at some point, like hydrogen fuel cells, for example. But those you have to change everything in order to do that. This is something that, you know, you could be running on a terribly, you know, polluting diesel bus today, and tomorrow you could be running biodiesel. It's available commercially, but it's also something that you can make at home, which is also something that makes it very, you know, unique and desirable, so that someone who owns a diesel vehicle could just begin making, with very little trouble, could begin making the fuel themselves. And the way you do that, we're not going to just go through the whole recipe, but if people are interested, they can contact me. I'll give that information later. You basically just, if you wanted to make it at home, you could collect waste fat from behind the Dunkin' Donuts or behind, you know, Duffy's. And mostly people don't mind, you know, they don't have much, they usually have to pay someone to get rid of it anyway. So you go and collect it, and you could mix it, you know, if you wanted to mix 5-gallon batches of it, you would get your methyl alcohol, which is basically dry gas, but you can also get it in larger quantities in other places, and your lye, which is basically Red Devil lye drain cleaner, but you can also get it in more pure forms, but that's the basic. And you determine the quantities of those two substances that you need to mix with the vegetable oil based on the pH of the fat that you've collected. And you mix those all together for a certain amount of time. You could use a blender if you're making a tiny little batch just to test, or you can use a big paint stirrer on the end of a electric drill if you want. And then you mix them all up, and then you let them settle, and it just, the glycerin drops off. You know, the glycerin separates from the methyl esters, and you can really see it's a straight cut. You can really see where the glycerin and the fuel divide, and then you just draw off the fuel and strain it and burn it in the motor. It's a fairly simple process.
So anyway, you know, clapping to the folks who produced that show out of WERU. I know Kathy's here from WERU. I don't know if anyone else is. So this is a way that we can pool our resources to make something happen. I know ultimately, for me, community radio is about making something happen. And, you know, we don't like the energy policy that's set by this nation. Well, let's set our own energy policy. You know, starting with ways to, grassroots radio really, I think, is about organizing people on the grassroots level to take control of our lives. So that's where we belong, and that's what we do. And any way that we can assist one another in actually, you know, making change in our world, those are the things that we need to take advantage of. And anyway, we are giving a workshop on the AINFOS Radio Project on Sunday morning for those who don't know what it is and want to learn how to use it, which is extremely easy. It was meant to be easy to use, so that you can utilize this material. Everything that people put up there is to share. So you put up to share stuff to share. Other people put up stuff to share. It is all free. And so anyway, so check it out. www.radioforall.net.
Okay, I'd like to open things up now. I have a question. Since this is being taped, how do you want to work it so that people, is there a microphone? There was a standing mic here before.
It stands there. There's a mic, too. I don't know how well.
You want to connect one of these mics? While Kevin is setting it up, maybe I'll ask the panelists if any of you want to either comment or respond or in any way to what anyone else said, you feel free to do so.
You're looking at me, why?
Anyway.
Is it on?
Are we ready to go?
Hello.
Marty, talk about Freedom 101. Get some Viagra and nothing, too.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add a couple of things about what we've been doing in Colorado to do the, well, here, let me do this. I'm sorry. To do this same kind of thing, we have a regional organization called the High Country Community Radio Collective, or Coalition. And in Utah, New Mexico, and Colorado, we're sharing programming we've gotten some grants for. One of them is called Thin Air. It's a little half-hour news magazine that's produced once a month, and we've gotten some CPB funding for that to share and do it through the internet, have different stations, producers at different stations contribute to the program in this little news magazine format, and then there's the money goes to pay the coordinator who puts the thing together, and it's produced once a month, and we all air it on all of our stations. It's just a cool, simple little cooperative effort. And the other thing we've done through that organization is that the KGNU news director got some money from the Rose Foundation and the Gay and Lesbian Fund of Colorado to report on the Colorado legislature. So he goes down there during the session and posts his stories to a website that works just like the A Infos Project. And then those stories are taken off by the other community radio stations in Colorado to play at their convenience on their own schedules. And these have been really, you know, we have gotten funding for them, but it's been very minimal funding and for sort of a maximum of effect, of impact. So that's just a real simple thing that could be adapted in other regions. If you, I know California, the Western states are having a conference soon, and this is something that could be done there and other places. First Amendment 101 or Freedom 101 is an idea that we came up with just recently to do some programming on First Amendment issues because of homeland security, you know, and various other initiatives by our government. It seems to be more and more of an issue, just preserving what's left of the First Amendment in particular. And so this is just an idea that's come up that the grassroots stations might be able to produce something like this and share it. It could be in module form, it could be a half hour, it could be more. You know, it could be something as grand as on the scale of Democracy Now that could be easily distributed via internet. And this is the revolution for us, is that we were never able to distribute before. You had to uplink to a satellite. You had to have a downlink, you know. And now that's all gone. We can all become producers. So it's an exciting thing in the world of grassroots radio. I just wanted to add that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Search and seizure. Yeah. My name is Susan Lee. I'm a producer from BAI, and I have a comment and then a question. And the comment is sort of not quite right for this, but I think appropriate. I got to know Lynn Gary through a listserv that she did. And I don't think it's appropriate just to thank Lynn Gary for her support for us winning back our network. I know that many of you organized and did all sorts of things, so thank you. Because without you, I don't think we'd be back. So, thanks. My question, though, is on the sharing. At BAI, we have a very delicate, difficult situation that many of you know about. And we literally have enormous staff apathy and unhappiness. And what I don't understand is you want to share radio stations, you know, radio programs, and yet we have a star system that is causing right now difficulties. What kind of balance do you have with your external, you know, bringing in a star, bringing in outside things, clipping things on to shows? How are you thinking about balancing these things with continuing staff vibrancy, which we don't have at BAI and which we need.
Who would like to respond to that?
I don't have an answer for it, but I think it's a good topic to talk a little bit about, because it the whole issue of national versus local, as Lynn said, how do we begin to frame this stuff? And I know observing within, I know WBAI and observing within Pacifica, and maybe Ralph, I'm going to flip this to you, because I think this is a question that the public airwaves have been struggling with for a long time. This question of, it's not that difficult, this idea of there's something going on here, there's something going on there, why can't we make, why can't we set aside time to hear from, what's happening in terms of water resources on the West Coast and what's happening in these areas. This is not that difficult an idea, and yet it seems, as Susan said, that the system, people become very proprietary about the time, about the resources, and the goals and the ideals of making and getting information out to people, become secondary. As you said, who cares who did the interview? Yeah. The core is, isn't this exciting? This woman's making this fuel in her blender. that's just like, who cares who's going to put the mic there? That's like a great story. And Ralph, you've been watching this. You've been watching public radio as well as Pacifica. This seems to be an inherent issue that we keep butting up into.
Maybe I do want to speak to this, because Sean and I do a weekly two-hour public affairs program. The material routinely that's broadcast every week on that program, a very small percentage of it is actually recorded by the four people in our production collective, because of course we can record whatever we happen to be near. We produce it out of our home, completely on our computer, and don't do phone interviews because we don't have a good way to do it. It's virtually impossible at this point. So we take some stuff from all over, and I guess I don't. When Susan made the comment, I was almost going to say that I didn't understand the question, and actually what it is that I don't understand. I understand the question. I don't understand the attitude. I'm really sick of this star system business. As I said, and that is the problem. The problem is not how to share files or how to do this. It's people who, instead of doing radio for service, it's become a big ego trip for them. And I can assure you that the people who think they're stars are not any better than most of the other people out there that they think are not important. And I'm sorry, Amy and Meredith at WERU are not stars, and they were able to put an interview on their radio station that's created a real-world impact in the Finger Lakes of New York. So, star schmar.
Can I ask a question? Wait, no, we want to finish with this, and then you can wait.
No, just a real quick, reiteration. Sometimes when we're at our own stations or our own projects, we think, the internal civil wars going on there are unique to ourselves, but they're not. I am in the middle of a horrendous, horrible set of battles at our station, and it revolves around the same issue of people, thinking that the airwaves have been privatized, that, an election comes up, September 11th comes up, and the news director, the public affairs coordinator want to interrupt regular programming as a service to our listeners, and there's resentment. If you can believe that, it's an extreme example. But we have some real horrible problems in that direction, and I think I won't repeat what you guys said, but I agree 100%. It's about ego, and we all have ego. You can't avoid that. That's why probably we're on the radio in the first place. But, yeah, the service part of it has gotten submerged. And I'll just tell one quick anecdote, and maybe you guys know about this, but I think it was KPFA, but somebody out there had actually drawn up a legal will with an attorney to will his time slot to his wife after he passed away.
So that's the extremes of where these things can go. Let me just add a thought to that, and then because this is an important issue, and I'd be interested in what people think about this or other questions that they have. I mean, I've been involved with Pacifica in one form or another, you know, for over 30 years, and have written about its history. I think everyone here knows that really, to a large extent, Lou Hill and Pacifica invented modern community radio and public radio and all the rest, and Lorenzo Milam started at Pacifica. However, one thing I've been thinking about quite a bit, at this point, I mean, I think there's a very important internal discussion, debate about kind of reinventing Pacifica that's going on, and hopefully the issues that have been, that were, this important issue that's been raised will be addressed in a constructive way. But one thing that I feel, and I feel it even more being here, is that at this point, things have gotten turned on their heads, and I think that Pacifica, in looking to sort of reconfigure itself, can learn a great deal from the community radio stations themselves and the way they do business. And one of the, you know, concerns that I have, you know, and it's been a problem, you know, I suppose with a lot of radio and especially at Pacifica, is that it seems to me that it would be desirable for more programmers to play the role less of, you know, basically presenting the information or their point of view and with this sort of ownership of the radio slot, and should function more like magazine editors, bringing, you know, the voices of different people in different communities and different perspectives to the air. Doing, and I think, you know, I was so blown away by Keith on Mo Fona, that whole spirit of really capturing, you know, the voices of the American people and in its real diversity. So, you know, there's much to be said here, but at least I want to, you know, throw those 2 cents in for whatever it's worth.
Well, I wanted to ask Lynn and I guess the rest of you to follow up on that, because I've been listening to KPFA and I find that there's a lot of individual-based time slots. You know, people who are the hosts are the center of the show, and you don't know where to go to listen to something that you're interested in. But is the alternative doing it by, you know, subject matter or what? Or do you have any ideas about what some alternatives could be to that kind of thing?
Ego training.
Well, yeah, it's structural. It's not just, you know, it's not just because we have a bunch of egomaniacs working with us.
Yeah, I mean, it's structural too, but I guess I wouldn't want to make some, to suggest that there be some, you know, hard and fast rule, because the fact is sometimes, you know, sometimes a host or listening to that particular person is meaningful in terms of its content or useful. Other times it's not. I think that you're probably right that there's a structural problem, but I think the structure goes deeper than how we schedule our radio stations, although the strip programming concept certainly contributes to this development of the personality, the somebody's show, and then the content is almost subservient to the host. I think part of the problem is this is embedded within our larger societal culture that is this way, and I don't know what to do about changing that except bringing it to our consciousness and making a conscious effort to change the way we think about it, and quite frankly to work on the problem of elitism, which is just as bad in community radio as it is everywhere else, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I would just say, just to bring it back to the fact that this is a radio conference, I think that the role of the producer is actually something that is, you know, that it's actually, it's just so interesting and it's so much fun. You functioned as a producer, as an editor, in finding that material and saying, you know, this would be great, it works for me, I'm interested in it, and I know my audience is. And I think it's one thing that I mean, my interaction with BAI, I mean, I could never get anybody to talk about, you know, how you're really making these programs, how you're shaping them. It's not as if a single voice can't present stuff, because Democracy Now! Is evidence of that. But Amy's not putting that show together every day. That show is segmented and is put together and is drafted, and there's a tremendous amount of work behind it. And I think that I worked with a lot of people over the years. I generally don't work as a reporter, generally not even on, do because I like the content. That's what I'm interested in. In the training that we do, as you begin to find people that you like, some people really are articulate, can present. There's a skill and an affinity, and but to do intellectual work, to really something present, we need to begin to work in consortium. Producing at NYC, we had a one-hour show which went to 3 hours. So successful. 1980, talk radio had really before AD. I was pulling off, finding people that were working. It was a real hybrid, and I think that's what, you know, a lot of people could work on it. I could bring in a lot of people. It was, we could use highly produced stuff. We could keep people's ear in different ways. It was so much fun. I mean, it's so interesting, and I think, I don't know what kind of training is going on now, but I think that really developing the idea of the role of editors and producers, what are the skills involved? And it's exciting, interesting, great work. And I agree with Lynn, you can make a difference. People make a difference. And that's the thing that it's so great that everybody's here. It feels good to have that renewed. I mean, that's the point of this work.
You want to add anything?
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Since KPFA came up, I thought I should say something because it has a lot to do with the GRC. My name is Mariah Gillarden. I'm producer of TUC Radio, and after having been banned in Pacifica, I was elected to the local advisory board at KPFA. And now we're facing a transitional period where there are many things we would like to do, but we're being told we're only advisory. So it's an interesting period. What we're seeing now in all clarity is that what happened in 1995 at KPFA was really very important, although it formally did not happen under the Healthy Stations project. It just happened naturally. The community programmers were eliminated from the schedule and replaced with music. That means like women, Native Americans, a bilingual program, a gay program that had a 7 to 8 slot shared among many people, a labor program was part of it, all replaced with music. And that's actually, you know, when I talk to people here now, they often say, well, it's hard for us to extend our public affairs program because the music programmers objected. And I find that a very pervasive and subtle form of censorship that really needs to be addressed. But more directly to these public affairs producers who were from the community, had a voice, a homelessness program was part of it. It's really, we just counted. We had 73 community-based programs with over 160 producers, and they're all eliminated with a stroke of a pen in 1995. Now we're inviting two of these back to serve on the general manager's search committee so they can help us find a better manager and not make this mistake again. What the station became then and still looks like is, to say it's privatized programming is actually a good point. It's sort of the WTO in your own private backyard. More programs were stripped across the schedule to be more recognizable, to get higher arbitrons, and more of them went into producers who then hired staff, who then hired board ops, and the programs are now across schedule in 4 areas through the day. Flashpoints is an example of good program. Living Room under Chris Welsh may not be as good as that because, well, I want to go into detail, but in all our memory, there was something in the conceptualization of Pacifica Radio that prevented that from happening. Those were departments. You may be astounded to hear that KPFA does not have a public affairs department. It does not exist. And I would think most of you have those at your stations. But who does not have a public affairs department where you're from? 2, 3, yeah. See, to have a public affairs department that consists of the community and volunteers and paid staff can actually be a conduit of these issues getting on the air. Could go on forever, but I wanted to throw it in because it's an interesting crossover of governance, community connection, and music as censorship.
I'm Brand. Is this working now? Oh. I'm Brandon Miller, and I'm from WRPI in Troy, and I'm also a professor in Integrated Electronic Arts Department. And what I'm really interested in, I actually am coming from community media making and video, but it's completely the same. I mean, and you could play my piece as a radio piece, and it's built to change my audience into activism. And when we look at like the case of Democracy Now! Right now, broadcasting on free speech TV, what we're really looking at in this time of converging technologies is all these movements. There's all these artificial divisions between the star and grassroots voices, but also between medium, so that the whole community radio movement is disconnected from the community media and video movement, and is now disconnected a lot from the community internet movement. And in a way, the community radio movement is the first. There are longer lessons to be learned. And the technologies keep changing, but it's really that community organizing part, that networking part that you're trying to strategize in radio, that we actually need to like blow apart more now and get rid of these artificial walls between the media. And I guess the greatest model right now is Democracy Now! On free speech TV, where all these movements are coming together. But do you have any strategies on that for networking? On passing on the lessons of community radio to these other movements who are now really struggling with the same issues, so we can really network and maximize the information technologies that are available to us to make change in our communities.
Any responses to that question up here?
I don't know. Does somebody in the audience want to respond? Yeah. Where do the people out here
maybe people
know as
spoken
much
up
as
so
we
far,
do?
Right. You know, yes.
You want to go up there?
I would like to know what Marty has to say, too.
Okay.
So would I.
Marty, go ahead.
No, that's fine.
Hi. I think I'd just like to say I'm from the Same Boat Coalition, which formed in 1994 when Newt Gingrich came to power, and we formed a coalition of coalitions on social and economic justice. And one of the first things we did was form a media collective out of that, and we started with cable network TV. And we started training ourselves first. And then what we did, because the cable network was brand new, is we started training groups in our coalition and then taking over programs. So now we have about 8 programs on that cable network, all out of the same coalition on different social and economic justice issues. At the same time, doing just what you said, we separately started dealing with WBAI to get a radio program on those issues, and they're still separate, although we've talked about bringing them together. And it's interesting that you bring it up, and I'm just saying because we have we're working in a larger collective sense, but we're still divided and need to bring that together. So I just wanted to point that out as in a sense we're the next step, but we're still very segregated. And we see that. And I've been talking about it because, in fact, I met Scott during Pacifica campaign when I went up to his station, and I've been getting and downloading his program and watching it mature over the year and a half since I met him, and it's been interesting to watch how that can happen, because that's through the internet. And so the question for me is, how do I not feel schizophrenic moving from one thing to the next, but how do I bring it together so that it's cohesive and so that we can really move all of ourselves on these issues which affect everybody. The way I put it is, we either live vertically or horizontally, but the issues remain the same. The issues really aren't very different. It's just architecturally different. So.
I'm coming into this discussion as kind of an outsider from a lot of the politics. But as an outsider's perspective, just a couple of gut reactions to what I've heard in a lot of the recent event splitting in the last 15 minutes. Word keeps coming in my head here, listener-centric. You know, the listener doesn't care let me rephrase it. The listener wants something that makes sense to them. So are you pulling stories together that make the story understandable? Or are you supporting a star? It's kind of like the statistics professor who's not there because he's good, but it's because he's tenured, as opposed to the grad assistant who everybody goes to because he makes it or she makes it clear. So that's my one thought. Just this whole concept of being listener-centric that I just get the feeling has been out of the discussion for the last 20, 25 minutes. So maybe I'm getting the wrong perspective here, but that's something that just was really reeking in the back of my head. And I guess from a music programmer standpoint of an independent show, yeah, music is censorship if you're Sony and Clear Channel. So thank you.
I'd like to hear from Marty, her thinking on this issue of the convergence of the different media. I just want to say while she's coming up that Dee Dee Hallock will be here and who has done a lot of important work in thinking around this issue. And while we need to do more, look, the independent media centers are a kind of model. You know, I would hope that at some point that there'll be in this conference some discussion of them, of their strengths, of their achievements. I know I'm talking on the phone with Lynn, the discussion of some of the problems, you know, or limits. But I think that at least some steps are being made.
Well, I just want to make a comment about what I think has been developed in community radio that could be passed on or joined together with these other media, and I think it definitely is time to do this, past time, and we do need to work together and not keep reinventing the wheel. But the main thing that is the problem for all these little independent medias is that is personal interaction and dealing with each other. And, you know, the technical stuff is slot A into slot B. I'm not saying it can't be creative. Of course it can. But, you know, this is easy for our human species. The hard thing is getting along and sharing power and dealing with all these nitty-gritty issues that, you know, we all deal with in our home lives. I'm sure. I don't know about you. Maybe you have a smooth one. You know, I mean, these things, this is where it's all really happening, and this is where we have to change. Because if we don't hang together, you know, we will hang separate.
I just want to start by saying that very sadly, WERU Programming Committee took TUC Radio off of our airwaves, and I've been grieving ever since. I just have to say that, and I'm working with other people to get it back on. It's an awesome program, and it activates community at a local and a global level. But in that music versus talk discussion, I just want to throw out some thoughts, and I'll elaborate more on the activist issue this afternoon in a workshop, but I have excitement about the exponential potential of our music programs for bringing information, and I'll just give you an example. I host a two-hour music program with an activist perspective called Off the Cuff, and what really excites me is that since 1988, since I've done this program, I have had hundreds, if not thousands, of community members on my show.
And I'm in a strip where, you know, there's a fellow on the day after me, and the day after that there's another fellow who never, ever have a guest on their show. And I love music. I'm a musician. Music brought me to the station, but I mix in features and talk so that so many community members have been on my program on everything from organic gardening to many nonprofits. I have a weekly feature, a 5 to 7 minute phone interview that the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine connects me with someone who's organizing an action or starting a new coalition or, you know, having the peace vigil. So I do that weekly interview. So that means that 52 different efforts get out there because of that. But now we have 6 or 7 peace and justice centers in our listening area. Some of them have told me that they were motivated by hearing these weekly, you know, peace and justice issues. The exponential potential part of it is don't think of it as your program. And, you know, that whole star bullshit really has to go. But I'll tell you what, we had our Full Circle Summer Fair 2 weeks ago, 4,000 people at a fairgrounds. I feel like a star when I have people saying, my kid was on your show, my mother was on your show, my neighbor was on your show. So, you know, the studio can be a lonely place if you let it be. If you're the one voice putting on the music, to me, a music program without some meat in it is like Muzak. And I don't care, you know, I know we bring the alternative music to the people as well, and that's really important. But I think that at your stations, you should work to establish a culture where anybody getting a show feels like they're a conduit, and that when someone calls me up, I automatically say, well, then come on next week and talk about it. Or can I put you on after this song, let's put you on the air. And even to the point of when I have concert tickets to give away, I never say, first caller, second caller, third caller. I play the band name game, and I give 15 minutes or 20 minutes or a half hour, and I say, all right, the theme is genetic engineering. I want you to make up a wild band name, and we'll put the names in a hat and pick the winner. You know, in other words, stimulating creativity and fun as well as activism. So think about the exponential potential. Picture how many people have been in the studio with you over the last year, and if it's less than a dozen, then you really need to crank it up. You know, I in my two-hour program, I must have 4 to 6 people each week, not to mention the off-the-cuff ones that come in by phone. So, thanks.
Yeah, I have a question. We talk about
could five... Could you identify
yourself? Yeah, my name is Hans. I'm a volunteer or activist in WBI Pacifica Struggle. We talk about file sharing. Idea sharing. Can we have, is there a group working who shares goals? We have all the community stations all over the states. Is there some group who sets goals? That's one station, some example, the story about the diesel fuel. Can we, just an example, can we have that 1 year long going on in every station, 1 hour a week, 1 hour a month, and popping up in 1 year, popping up a big, every community has its own fuel-making facilities.
I think it's an interesting question, I want to just, because it's related to something that I've thought about. Part of the power, it seems to me, of community radio and Pacifica is to put on the national agenda, maybe left at first, but ultimately more broadly, key important issues. And it's an interesting political question. How does one prioritize, or should we be trying to do that and making that kind of impact over and beyond misprogramming on things that are of concern to us? Interesting question. I don't know how to answer it, but I'd be curious if people have any thoughts about it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we have on, by having whatever it is that we do have on the station, we are prioritizing something, whether consciously. I'm not sure that, I think within a station, I would say within people that are doing news at a station or public affairs or whatever, I think people at that station could develop priorities about what they think are the most important stories and issues in their community, and I think they should. In terms of something called, quote, the left, deciding what the priorities are, that's a no-go with me personally. I think let people come from deciding their priorities where they can meet face-to-face, not have it handed down by, you know, some, central committee. You know, that just really, we've seen that just really doesn't work. Things need to grow from the roots up to the top, I think.
I think Lynn is right. I think a number. Oh, I'm Andrea Fishman. I've been active in Pacifica at BAI, but also I'm part of the Pacifica Matters, a coalition for Democratic Pacifica. Coalition for my God, a culture for democracy. I'm also part of Coalition for Democratic Pacifica, but. What Pacifica Matters is, it was conceived of as a result of a national board meeting in New York for Pacifica, as a way of having all five stations speak to each other nationally each week in a simulcast on the radio for 3 hours to be talking about governance at the local level and at the national level. And I'm, on the one hand, I'm glad to say that Pacifica picked up on this and has had a few national simulcast days and is planning more. But on the other hand, this idea has met with nothing but resistance. And what is important about this idea, we feel, is that it's really a way of creating a participatory democracy. And eternal vigilance is the cost of freedom, and right now, more than ever. And I think that there is a danger, first of all, of not having this. You lose the community's input. You lose the community's ideas and possible solutions to huge problems. But you lose the community's vested interest, vested and ability to know what's going on, ability to be informed, and the ability to actually save the network, or to save our freedom of speech, never mind the network, to save all of our abilities to speak, the freedom of inquiry. But there's something else that I think is lost if the community, if in some way participatory structures are not created, which is no matter how good the information is, and all these ideas, I mean, there, for example, there were a couple of people who joined in the Pacifica Matters development, and their idea was really pre-produced programming, most of it. They felt that participation on the part of all the network communities was beyond the scope of the project. But this is the heart of the project, and that it is no matter how good the information is, if you are constantly on the receiving end of this information, someone is always giving it to you, but you have no power to participate in what goes on the air, or to determine in any way what goes on the air, or to determine in any way how the air is structured or designed, you are rendered immobile and inert. I mean, you're rendered powerless, and your frustration and helplessness and hopelessness are only increased on an unconscious daily level. Your sense of your ability to change your world could be non-existent. So I think it's very important that we really think in terms of not just allowing the community to speak and tell its stories, which is very important, but really the community must be the determining factor finally in some way of how it controls its own lives, the top finds itself determined. So I think it's very important that we think of turning this around somehow.
All right, we've got about 5 minutes left, so we've got time for a few more people to come
up. I just want to make one comment on this point and the idea of how, what kind of topics and what do we get into. And I agree, and I guess I sort of see the model in some way as going, so to say, to look at The point is, I love that story about the reparations issue, which was an issue that obviously was being worked on in New Haven. And then they found out that, and then the information came out about Yale. But because there was already a relationship and there was, it wasn't just a reactive story that got dropped in. There was a lot of other information that came out of that. So it became a much more thoughtful piece. And I think what happens in the media is the media becomes very reactive. Something happens and it gets covered. And that's where I guess I sort of agree with Ralph that I think that within the community, community groups are looking at, I mean, right now, and there are people who are thinking about water resource issues because they know that in the next 5 years, it's going to hit. It's going to become a big story. I think that ideally, in my idea of the way that it ideally would work, we would be getting information from those groups who are already doing the research, from some of the scientists and people within research areas, and we would be looking at, okay, this is going to hit. The policy issues, we better be ready to answer questions and be involved because the policy is going to get set without our permission, without our interaction. It's going to be set because there are huge economic issues. And that's where it works. It's not as if, I mean, I guess that's the ideal, that's an ideal scenario for me, that to some extent those people who are engaged in issues in their community are the media people, the grassroots folks, people with microphones, begin to find out and begin to think about what are the agenda items that are really affecting our community. And so we're less reactive. But it's not as if the grassroots is necessarily setting the agenda. We're working together to affect policy, which is going to really affect our lives. And as you know, we hang together or we hang alone. I mean, we're getting closer.
Frieda Worden from WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. I wanted to talk about collectives, but briefly I wanted to say something about what Karen just said, because we just put on WINGS a piece that is with an interview with the one of the producers of FIRE, Feminist International Radio Endeavor in Costa Rica, and they were doing interviews about local reactions to and strategizing around oil exploration that was coming in their part of the country. And because they had those interviews and they had them online, when the organizers needed a book to put together to lay on the legislators' desk, they found this stuff online. They said, oh, let's just transcribe it. We have a book. And the book became a very important piece then of getting the people's voice into the legislative agenda. So I want to say, you know, having these things, what we do is very important, and to archive and to be able to access stuff. And the other thing I came up here to say was about collectives. Because in the process that happened at Pacifica that I noticed, or KPFA, I was particularly concerned because the women's department, which I had always liked, was disbanded. And one of the rationales was, well, they haven't been able to keep a consistent voice on the air. You know, it's very patchy what they're doing and this kind of thing. And that comes out of the NPR audience research. People want to hear the same voice week after week, you know, this kind of authoritative thing. But when we started Co-op Radio in Austin, I mean, Co-op has had its good and bad points, but one of the good points that has really succeeded was that we established, based on the idea of a women's collective, which was the first one to form, other programming collectives. So we ended up with an environmental collective, we had a Latino collective, we had a spoken word collective, you know, just around whatever the interests were. And by having these collectives, it provided not only a place where people could have input into the content, but also then the collectives made their recommendations to the programming committee about which things in their area of interest they wanted to support to get on the air. And I've seen collectives that worked well and ones that didn't, but that's true with everything. And I think for community radio, it's a good model.
Okay, it's 12:15, so I don't want to be responsible for people missing their lunches, so I'm going to call it to a close and thank especially our three panelists for sharing their work and their thought, as well as the audience for its contribution.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you,
Ralph.
That was good. It really, thank you.
Yeah, I'm really good. Yeah, same here.
Thank you.